Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Green Space today. And with me now in the Green Space, Masha Gessen, the Russian-American journalist, seen prominently in the New York Review of Books, author of several books, including The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and now a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Her latest article for them this month was called Trump's Incompetence Won't Save Our Democracy. She also has a chilling but must-read essay in the July Harper's Magazine with the real deal history that we'll talk about called The Reichstag Fire Next Time. Hi, Masha. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And welcome to the Green Space. The Reichstag Fire. For people who don't know about that part of Hitler's march to totalitarianism, what was it and how did he use it to create what you call a state of exception?
Actually, I don't call it the state of exception. His favorite legal theorist, Carl Schmitt, called it the state of exception. So very soon after Hitler was appointed the Chancellor of Germany, the Reichstag, the seat of the German parliament, burned. And a young Dutch communist was arrested for setting the fire and sentenced to death and decapitated. But it set in motion, or Hitler used it as a pretext to create a whole set of restrictions on media, on political parties, on protest, etc. And it's seen widely as a turning point in Hitler's rise to power, Hitler's, as you said correctly, the march to totalitarianism. I think as all sort of such historical turning points, it's a little bit too convenient, and it was much more of a continuum than we like to think. But it's become a phrase that denotes a turning point, the dawning of a state of exception.
And you give many other examples in your article of leaders who use an event to declare states of exception and seize extraordinary powers. Vladimir Putin, beginning in the late 90s, after a series of apartment bombings in Moscow by Chechen separatists, but also in this country by presidents including Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and George W. Bush. And your point, I think, is that we are well on the way toward an extreme state of emergency and seizure of authoritarian powers, potentially by Donald J. Trump, if there is a significant terrorist attack. Can you talk, for history's sake, about Woodrow Wilson's Sedition Act of 1918 as an example from history that I think most people today don't know? You quote a historian who calls it the most repressive legislation in American history.
You know what? I'm actually not comfortable talking about it. I wrote that essay a few months ago, and I'm afraid of getting my facts wrong as I talk here live. I think if we could fast forward to the present,
sure.
That'd be great.
And I'll just say, for the sake of historical context, that there were the Alien and Sedition Acts of 100 years earlier, Lincoln suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War, the internment of the Japanese during World War II. We don't have to linger on each of those, but flash forwarding to the present. And by the way, I say this to guests rarely, so this is an occasion when it's warranted. I so appreciate when people say, "I don't know." Because so many people would fake their way through it and might actually give misinformation. But you call the modern era since 9/11 unique in that we are in a war that cannot be won, therefore a state of emergency powers that cannot end.
So my point is that since Trump was elected, we've been hearing this phrase, the Reichstag fire, quite a lot. And a lot of the time, it's this idea that something is going to happen. There's going to be a terrorist attack on American soil, and Trump is going to use it as pretext to create all sorts of emergency powers. My argument is that already happened. That happened 15 and a half years ago. And what we're seeing now is very much a result of that happening after 9/11. We've basically been living in a state of emergency, and unlike other American states of emergency, although they have mounted over the years, right? But unlike other states of emergency, which were often deemed unconstitutional, or at least ended after a war ended. This one can't end because a war on terrorism cannot be won, right? We don't know the objective of this war. I mean, is it to eradicate terrorism as a tactic? That's never going to happen. Is it to eliminate the threat of terrorism? How are we going to measure that? Right? And in fact, the fact that we talk about how this terrorist attack on American soil is inevitable is a case in point. Because since 9/11, there have been very few attacks, very few deadly attacks. This is not one of the big threats facing this country, right? But we keep talking about it because it's a mobilizing tactic, which is actually a very important feature of a state of exception.
But it's also real as an ongoing threat. I mean, we see all these incidents that keep happening in Europe and no particular reason to think that things like that won't happen here. They're starting to come closer together in Europe than they did before, which makes them feel salient as something other than, you know, the event more rare than being struck by lightning, which I guess statistically it still is.
It still is. You're much more likely to die from your flat panel television falling on you than you are in a terrorist attack in this country. But also, the existence of a threat is not an excuse for a state of emergency.
Now, state of emergency. You remind us that Bush declared an actual national state of emergency, and he and Obama have renewed it every year since. I think people don't know that. Obama did. He didn't make a big show of it.
Every September since 9/11, the President of the United States has renewed a state of emergency.
And you write that Congress is supposed to vote on a national state of emergency, but never has.
Never has happened. In this sense, 9/11 is not an exception. Congress has never voted on other states of emergency that have been declared. At any given time, this country is in the midst of many different states of emergencies. There was Obama declared a state of emergency for swine flu, for example, right? And that happily expired, unlike the state of emergency in response to the terrorist threat.
Does this sound worse than it actually is in civil liberties terms? Dissent is everywhere. Progressives call themselves the resistance. At the Oscars, at the airports when the travel ban was announced, on CNN and the Washington Post and New York Times websites 24 hours a day, in your op-eds and magazine articles?
It depends on your frame of reference. I think you could say it sounds worse than it actually is if you compare it to a country where there's actual restrictions on speech. Obviously, it is night and day. If you compare it, on the other hand, to sort of the ideals that this country holds dear, if you compare it to the healthy state of the public sphere, then I think it's much more problematic. And my issue, where I'm trying to pick a fight, is with the assumption that things were fine until suddenly Trump happened to us.
Right. And you're making that case. And listeners, you can call in and talk to journalist Masha Gessen, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or people here in the green space, you can raise your hand and we'll come around with a microphone. You write that a key characteristic of the most frightening regimes of the last 100 years is mobilization, and Trump seems to know how to use it. What is mobilization used this way?
Mobilization is when, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a sense of a state of war. And this country has been living with the sense of being under siege, under threat, for nearly 16 years now. It's a sense of being united and being part of something greater than a collection of individuals who create the population. And it was as important to Hitler as any of the restrictions he placed after the Reichstag fire. And I think that a lot of the more insightful people who wrote about the transformation of Germany under Hitler focused much more on the demonstrations, the public show of mobilization, than on legal restrictions.
And you make a distinction in the Harper's article between authoritarians and totalitarians and what they want from the public. Can you describe that distinction and why it matters?
That distinction is precisely mobilization, Authoritarians are rulers who want to accumulate power and accumulate wealth while the population is not paying attention. They want you to stay home and tend to your families while they do their thing, and leave them alone to sort of to rule the country as a single individual or a small group. Totalitarian rulers want you out in the square demonstrating in support of their war efforts, right? Whether it's a war against an external enemy or an internal enemy. And Trump is very, I mean, I'm not by any means saying that he's building a totalitarian regime or that he's capable of it. What I'm saying is that he's a totalitarian type leader, right? What he craves is mobilization.
And the fight that you said a minute ago that you're trying to pick, against the idea that things were fine until America inexplicably elected Donald Trump. You put that in the context of that's a fundamental flaw that most recent protests share, and that to be worthy of the lofty name resistance, the aim must be to break the country's whole post 9/11 trajectory. You think people don't get that? You think they're protesting sort of the wrong thing? And if so, what needs to be done?
I think a lot of the individuals who have been organizing the protests, who have been participating in the protests, very much get that. At the same time, I think the slogans that the protests often read as though things were fine until Trump happened. And I really think that it's very difficult in something as short and pithy as a slogan to sort of to create historical context. But I really think we need to be aware of it, and we need to try to figure out how to do it, because we're not just protesting the rise of Donald Trump. And I think, you know, Trump is a leap, but not a quantum leap. It's more, you know, he's more of a leap from a running start.
Let's take a question from here in the green space. Hi there.
Hello. Picking up on what you just said and how Trump has exacerbated these issues, and your article about surviving in the time of an autocrat, which inspired us in Jayfridge and our resistance, how do you see, what would your slogan be, Masha? What would you say is the good strategy for us who see it in the long run and not just these particular issues now?
Well, it's hard to come up with a slogan on the spot. See, I usually write these things that, you know, for the 5,000 words, not five words. But I think, you know, I want to see demonstrations and protests against the concept of a war on terrorism. Right? I think that, I mean, one of the things that I mentioned in the essay and that were really painful for me to watch was actually President Obama's farewell speech, in which he said, responding to Trump, he said about American Muslims, he said, they are as patriotic as we are. And it goes without saying that they are not us, right? That's what we need to be demonstrating against, right? And it is inspiring and awesome that this country comes out sort of in a spontaneous show of response to injustice in response to the travel ban. But the travel ban wouldn't even be conceivable if it hadn't been for the last 16 years. And somehow we need to take that into account.
Your Times op-ed, Trump's incompetence won't save our democracy. That's the title, the headline. You say a careful reading of history reveals people at the time to have thought both Hitler and Stalin as men of limited ability and imagination. Were they incompetent in anything resembling the ways we see Trump as?
They were absolutely, well, I mean, not so much Stalin, who had a different historical context, but very much Hitler was seen as a buffoon. I mean, contemporary analysts refused to take him seriously because he was so foreign to the political culture of the time. And I think that that's part of what we see with Trump. I mean, how can you analyze his tweets? I mean, at this point, we hear less of these calls for ignoring his tweets. And wouldn't it be brilliant if we could do journalism and not read what the president has to say? I mean, that it's... This resistance that we have to the reality of Donald Trump because he is insulting to our intelligence.
And you personally vouch for the fact that Vladimir Putin might be in this camp, even though we consider him right now sort of the puppet master interfering with all these Western democracies. How so?
Well, he is. I've studied him and I've met him, and he is not a mastermind of anything. He is a poorly educated, extremely uncurious, self-satisfied buffoon. He's a very different kind of buffoon than Trump is. Trump, and the biggest difference between them, of course, is inexpressiveness, right? Trump is raw emotion, and Putin prides himself on controlling his emotions. But that doesn't mean that there's more there.
So who has another question? Let me give the audience another chance. We have a hand up right over there. Hi.
Just to tie this discussion to the previous one, hasn't Trump's incompetence, though, led to a situation where all that needs to happen is a flip of the House, which will inevitably lead to 2 years of articles of impeachment being brought and his administration being unable to function beyond having to be responsive to this investigation? It seems beyond protest, simply flipping the House 30 seats is enough to stop the entire exercise in its tracks.
I think you're making a couple of assumptions. One is that flipping the House is simple. So far, and we're now 6 months into this year, so far there isn't a whole lot of indication that the House is about to get flipped.
We'll get an indication in Georgia tonight, probably.
Well, we'll see, right?
But, one indication.
And let's hope so. But the other thing is, the point of that op-ed is actually to take issue with an argument that's become commonplace, which is that Trump is so incompetent that he can't create fascism, right? And it's a basic misunderstanding, because Trump's agenda is very much lies in destroying political culture and political institutions as we know them in this country. That's very much a fascist agenda, and is an agenda that goes hand in hand with incompetence, right? It's this message of militant stupidity, right? You don't need expertise, you don't need complexity, things can be very, very simple. And so the second assumption I think you're making is that he is not succeeding in that process of destruction, and I disagree. We're seeing more and more evidence of how successful, for example, his destruction of the entire foreign policy establishment of this country is. I mean, the State Department very nearly lies in ruins, and we're only 6 months into this.
You're right. Well, basically, I'm paraphrasing now, but basically you say his simpleton's insistence on simplicity can lead us to autocracy.
Absolutely. Autocracy is a primitive way of governing. And I think that's what draws him to it. He really thinks that the country should be run like The Apprentice.
So on the whole Trump world and Russia thing, do you see the lines, or maybe you see something between the lines that most Americans might not easily see with your knowledge of Russia as well as the United States, where collusion during the campaign might have taken place? Because in fairness to Trump, the great investigative minds don't seem able to find it, at least so far.
I would not be surprised if we never found it. Because I mean, I have a few issues with this with this whole story, and I've written about it. I'm really concerned about sort of the conspiracy thinking rabbit hole that so many people on the left side of the political spectrum have descended into. Because and what I mean by conspiracy thinking is not to say that there's nothing there. What I mean is that conspiracy thinking becomes dangerous and becomes an actual conspiracy theory when you think that there's one thing that explains everything. And Russia is great because it explains how we got Trump and how we're going to get rid of Trump. And it's not so simple, because Russia actually does not explain how we got Trump. It is extremely unlikely that collusion can be proven, and furthermore, that it can be proven that collusion actually had some sort of impact on the outcome of the election. And if any of that is found, it is extremely unlikely that that will lead to Trump's disappearance, right? I mean, the mechanisms at the moment aren't there. At the very least, the House needs to be flipped, right? So So it's not sort of a one-stop shopping solution to Trump. But I also think that ultimately the investigation is likely to yield a lot of mess. A lot of money that the Kremlin throws at various projects that are sold to the Kremlin as efforts to undermine Western democracy. A lot of contacts that happened but had no continuity, right? A lot of loose ends. Neither the Trump campaign nor the Russian government are well-run systems or highly organized systems or run by people who have any planning horizon, right? So who are actually able to hold a thought for a long time. So I think what we're finally going to end up with after years of investigation is just a giant mess.
Let's take a phone call. Here is Wally on Staten Island. Control room, that's line 6. Can we get Wally on the air? Wally on Staten Island, or on Staten Island. You could be in an island. You can be on an island. You're on WNYC. Wally, hi.
Hi, thank you so much. I really appreciate the commentary. So I'm in total agreement with the presenter today. You know, I feel like this mobilization thing is more profound to someone like me, a Muslim American who sees, you know, things like the Patriot Act impeding on our civil liberty in a more profound way as a Muslim American's versus non-Muslims in this country who see a rationale behind the restrictions and the violations of civil liberties on Muslim Americans as a necessary evil. But they don't see how eventually the Patriot Act could come back to haunt the rest of America and violate civil liberties for everyone else in this country.
Wally, thank you very much. Masha?
I agree with every word Wally said.
Wally, thank you very much. So I'm going to go on to another call. Paul on Staten Island as well. Boy, you've got a fan base on Staten Island.
Hi,
did you have any idea? Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. So I'd like to say I really like what you said about simplicity. And, you know, Trump competes on the emotional level. And it's hard to compete against him, you know, saying he's keeping people safe. And that continues the supposed necessity of the Patriot Act. So how do we compete on the same level or compete against those tactics in a way that brings people to our side of the argument rather than just continues to divide?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, Trump's message, this message of simplicity, which is actually common to strongmen all over the world, it really goes to the source of the fear. It's frightening to live in a complicated world. And what these men are saying is, look, things are really simple. Like, you don't need a lot of bureaucracy. You don't need any of the stuff that you don't understand. I am going to make the world make sense to you. And in doing that, they all invariably appeal to this idea of an imaginary past. Some time that we never lived through, but we think was a simpler time, right? When we felt comfortable and not so scared. And I think that the way to fight it, and something that the Democratic Party has not done, and has not, I think, even tasked itself with doing, is with a vision of a glorious future. Right. Instead of saying, look, things are fine the way they are, which was very much the Democratic message during the election, we're great because we're good. Right. Instead of saying we're fine the way they are, which is a terrible message to send to people who actually find the world frightening and uncomfortable and who have objective things happening to them that are not at all fine. Right. To say we can be better. It has to be aspirational, and it has to be future-oriented.
We're just about out of time. A couple of things breaking in the news just this morning. One, CNN is reporting that FBI director nominee Christopher Wray deleted a line from his online bio that showed him at odds with the Russian government. Interesting. And despite all of Putin and Trump's, you know, bromance and coziness, today we seem to be on the brink of war at some level. A Russian plane came within shouting distance of an American one over Syria today after the U.S. shot down that Syrian war plane yesterday. What do you make of it?
Well, what frightens me about Trump and Putin is not the idea of a bromance or a long honeymoon. The idea, actually, what frightens me is that they're both temperamental, aggressive, unsophisticated men who think that power, that being a leader is exercising raw power, and who think that going to war is what makes them strong. Right. And I was terrified during the election that this was where we're going to end up after the shortest honeymoon in history was a confrontation. Putin has also pursued this image of the crazy guy, the madman on the international stage. And now there's an actual madman on the international stage. And both of them have their finger on the nuclear button. And I think, you know, that's what makes our world truly terrifying.
Masha Gessen is the Russian-American journalist seen prominently in the New York Review of Books, author of books including The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and now a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Her latest article for them this month was called Trump's Incompetence Won't Save Our Democracy. She also has a chilling but must-read essay in the July Harper's Magazine with the real deal history called The Reichstag Fire Next Time. A couple of the tweets coming in, Masha, listener Jacob says, your guest Masha Gessen is scaring the crap out of me. And listener Chris writes, I just want to say, Masha Gessen rules. She just rules, that is all. So that is all. Thank you for coming in.